All right. So this is Adventures in Melody with Anna Weaver, and you're listening to 89.9, the commercial free voice of Hope College. I'm on the phone with John Flansburg, songwriter and guitarist of They Might Be Giants. Hello, John. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing good. So is everything recording? You got to see the levels going and everything?
Yeah, I'm looking at it. Looks good.
Fantastic.
Yes, this is so exciting. So you've got a new album coming out in March.
Yes.
Nanobots. Why Nanobots?
Yes. Lots of things are happening. We have three tracks that are out right now that are like preview tracks from the album. We have this new iPhone app, and we've got a new album coming out, and we're going on tour in like a week.
Yeah.
So it's all like, it's like this collision of too many things.
That's so exciting. Are you just like super busy with all the stuff going on?
I'm kind of losing my mind a little bit, you know. I mean, I'm also like just like dealing with a ton of like personal family things that are just like absolutely impossible. So it's just you know, the life of an itinerant musician is filled with unexpected drama.
Yeah, I bet.
I just wish everyone would be a little bit nicer to me.
I'll be nice to you. It really is lovely to talk to you. I mean,
it's lovely to talk to you.
Thank you. I've been a big fan for so long. So
excellent.
And
well, I mean, we've been around for so long. It's weird, you know. Like, we actually are. This is our 16th album, and it's finally gotten to a point where people are like, why did you make this album? It's like, I don't know, man. This is what I do. You know, I'm not sure if it's important that you make a 16th album, but we had an interesting time doing it. John Linnell actually researched 16th albums online, and there's some really good ones. There's definitely like Some Girls was the 16th album
by
the Rolling Stones, and Bob Dylan's The Basement Tapes was his 16th album. No, that's a pretty great album. So it's like, there's some hope for us, people crossing the 16th album precipice.
Yeah, you're in good company. I mean, you're not, you know, you might not be washed up considering the evidence.
Yes, exactly.
I mean,
exactly.
I don't think you're washed up, but I mean, other people might not also. I don't know what I'm saying.
I understand. I don't know what I'm saying either.
Okay, well that's good then.
So what kind of music do you play in your show?
On my show, just a lot of alternative and some, like, classic rock. Big mix of stuff. I mean, I pretty much just play what I want.
Uh-huh. Well, that's cool.
It's not...
So when you say alternative, do you mean, like, contemporary alternative rock or, like...
Yeah. Well, and like, some older stuff. There's not really a theme. I play a lot of you guys.
What's like, the new thing on the playlist? Like, what are the new bands?
What are the new bands? We've been playing a lot of Jack White recently. He put out an album last year, I think, Blunderbuss. That was pretty good.
Hmm. You play Deer Tick?
I have not personally played Deer Tick. We do on this station.
Right, right. I kind of like those Deer Tick guys. I mean, it's sort of strange because, like, I remember there was a band, like, they're so much like The Replacements. It's kind of weird. I really love The Replacements, so it's not hard to hear a band that's like The Replacements. But I know there was some band out a couple of years ago that were so much like New Order, and it just seemed like, but there already was a New Order, you know?
Right.
But
you don't feel that way about Deer Tick.
Say what?
But you don't feel that way about Deer Tick.
No, I really like. I mean, you know, they do their own thing too. I mean, it's not like they're like they don't have their own. They've got a sense of style and songwriting, but there's also this thing where, you know, the guy's voice is really, like, got that, you know, blown out, crazy, like, I've been drinking all day kind of
For sure.
Vibe to it. So, I don't know. I like them.
Do you know Jukebox the Ghost?
Excuse me?
There's a band, Jukebox the Ghost. I don't really know how popular they are.
No, I don't know. I mean, I basically have my finger off the pulse because I spend a lot of my musical listening time listening to music that's kind of, well, these days, a lot of music that's sort of pre-rock. I mean, I spent my whole childhood and kind of young adulthood, just being completely immersed in the world of rock music. And
right.
I feel like I've graduated to exploring popular music before the rock era, which is really interesting. But it's not like
right.
other people are talking about it.
Right.
It's like kind of a insular. I mean, sometimes I think about like actually doing radio, thinking how much fun it would be to have a radio show, because it would give you the excuse to play and explore all this
right.
other stuff.
Yeah. Oh, it definitely is. I mean, like, I don't have like a set theme to my show, so I just like listen to a bunch of music and like I play stuff I like. So
right.
I'm glad that we're laid back enough here that the people in charge aren't like, you know, that's like not interesting to someone who's not you. Like, so I'm lucky in that aspect.
Well, I mean, the tradition of college radio is like free form radio, right? I mean, that's what it's
mm-hmm.
that's what it's all about. So
right,
like, you should be able to do stuff. You play hip hop?
I personally don't as right. much.
That's cool.
what kind of like pre-rock sort of stuff are you listening to? Give me some recommendations. It's not my area of expertise.
Well, I mean, I sort of have a couple of different kind of oddball obsessions. There's a whole world of like soul music and R&B music from the 60s that I really love. Some of it's out of New Orleans. Like, there's this guy, Eddie. A lot of things were produced by this guy, Alan Toussaint, or Toussaint. I actually still don't even know how to pronounce his name. He ultimately became famous as a horn arranger and a record producer in the 70s and worked with the group The Band.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that sort of, that thing you hear with like on those like the last waltz with The Band, a lot of those horn arrangements are him.
Oh, cool.
But he had a very cool New Orleans kind of sound. He's a keyboard player. He's a very interesting musician. But he produced all these other things too. Hold on 1 second. Send him on up. I'm at a friend's house here.
Oh. Okay.
There. Like, so the New Orleans stuff is very cool. And there's a label called Eccentric Soul, which has got a really interesting bunch of compilations of, like, rare R&B. But, like, just the world of soul music in the 60s, like Sam and Dave and Stax stuff is really always interesting to me. Like, kind of beyond Motown, I guess, is really the...
Right.
If oldies radio has sort of killed Motown, or like Motown has become like a zombie music sound. You just heard it so much, it doesn't really mean anything.
Oh, yeah.
Sometimes when you hear a song like that you've heard on the radio a million times, but you've never really listened to the fidelity of it, it actually can be kind of exciting to like give a critical listen to like a song. Recently, I heard the song "Wild Thing" by the Troggs.
Oh, right, because the singer died recently.
Yeah, the singer died. It was actually before he died. I just happened to hear "Wild Thing," and the quality of the song. I mean, it's a great recording. It's like super exciting.
Right.
So, hold on 1 second. I just have to. You got it? Okay, cool. Everything's cool.
Okay.
But, you know, it's a much more interesting song if you actually pay attention to it than, like, if it's just kind of coming out of, like, some
right.
speaker, you know, in, like, a scene in a movie. I mean, there's something very backgroundy about the way a lot of
right.
classic music is presented. That I guess oldies radio is kind of a bad thing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I feel that way about the classic rock station around here, because, I mean, like, they play, like, the same, like, you know, 100 songs. And, like, you think, like, from, like, the decades you're selecting, like, so much music came out, and you have to, like, pick those 100 songs to play over and over. It gets,
well,
like,
there's also kind of there's, like, a cultural leveling thing that happens with, like, something like classic rock that is very, you know, I mean, just speaking as, like, a super old dude, it's like, I grew up in an era before classic, you know, the idea of classic rock was invented in my lifetime. You know, like I remember it happening in sort of kind of the advent of classic rock in the early 80s, mid 80s is really when that format kind of started. And it sort of unified a lot of things in the same sort of boring way that people go talk about punk rock.
Right.
As if it's like just the Ramones and like clothes bought at Hot Topic. You know, it's just
right.
There's more to it than that. And mm-hmm. and it was a more dynamic, kind of interesting enterprise before it was sort of packaged, you know, the sort of packaged right. rebellion. Like classic rock, I don't know, it's well, I guess the one good thing about classic rock is that it kind of resurrected the legitimacy of like Led Zeppelin, who I have to say in their time were not, I mean, they were not that respected. I mean, they were, right. they were, you know, like somebody, your friend Stoner brother really loved Led Zeppelin, and the guy who beat you up in high school really loved Led Zeppelin, but like they weren't considered, they weren't that critically respected.
Right.
And it's interesting to see how much they've become like, there's so much, they loom so much larger now because of classic rock radio.
Right. That's good.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they're a really good band. You know, I think like it's sort of interesting to see, like, I mean, it seemed like they were the soundtrack to the villains of my teenage years. But the actual music is very good. I mean, I got no beef with Jimmy Page.
Right.
I don't want to start that beef with Jimmy Page up again on the radio.
Right. Not going to start the feud back up.
No.
I'm scared for, like, you know, in 20 years or whatever, like, I find myself wondering, like, what two bands that I listen to are people going to remember? It's...
Well, you know, this is a really curious time for popular music. I mean, like, when you look at the charts, like, the songs that are number one, I feel like there's probably, in the past 2 years, there have been a dozen songs featuring cameos by Justin Timberlake that I don't know... if I even know, like, how the chorus goes.
Right.
And it's weird for me just because I've been tracking popular music my whole life. I mean, I just, from the age of four till the age of, I don't know, into my 40s, like, there was very few things that I was not, about popular music, I was not kind of fascinated by.
Right.
And now pop seems so kind of Kardashian in a way.
Yeah.
And it makes me sad just because, like, I mean, I really do, like, that was my thing. Like, that was the thing I loved.
Right.
And just kind of not, and, you know, as I say, like, you know, I mean, I like a lot of hip-hop and, you know, I love Kanye West, but I feel like there needs to be more definitive stuff happening somehow.
Right, I can see that. I mean, nowadays there's almost a feeling that, like, once enough people have heard of it, it's not, like, legitimate, which is super weird to me.
Well, that's always. I mean, I remember as a teenager thinking the Clash had sold out. that seems really weird to me now. But you know, there's a sense of like ownership when it, like, if you follow a band that's not that well known. Or what do you call it, like connoisseurship, like you feel like
right.
you have unique access to their
yeah.
thing.
I mean, it's super weird for me to see the group Fun, like, winning Grammys, because the first time I saw them was in a room with like 50 people, and then I just, like,
right.
met them directly afterwards and just walked off the stage and was like, hey, the 50 people we just played for.
Right. Well, I mean, Fun is a really good example of a band kind of being like shot out of the pop culture canon. Like they have existed for a little while,
right?
But their ascent has been pretty steep. But
yeah.
I think that those guys have a very unneurotic approach to their careers. Like they're not too worried about. I think they seem like they're pretty confident that they're going to blow up in
right.
a good way. And they're just kind of taking it all in stride.
I
don't know. I don't know them. But I heard very early on in Fun's career, I heard an interview with like the the front man.
Right.
And he seemed seemed really strangely self-actualized. I wish I had like a tenth of that when I was. How old are they? I can't even tell.
Like half mid 20s, probably.
Yeah. Yeah.
Middle
it's so unusual to have that level of poise. I mean, both John and I were like so riddled with self-doubt for like the first, I don't know how many years we were in the band. It just was, it just didn't seem like.
Oh.
I don't know.
For real? Like for how long?
I got problems.
When did you guys like hit the point where like you believed you were that popular? Because I mean,
it was a very slow road out of New York. We like basically we started them at the Giants when I was going to Pratt, which is our school in Brooklyn, and John had moved to New York with his band the Mundanes,
mm-hmm.
and we just kind of did local shows for a number of years, from like 82 to 85. And then we made an indie record that came out at the end of 85, I guess. It was a really, we were a local band in New York for a very long time.
I know you released like a demo tape and that got like weirdly like popular. Like wasn't it reviewed in People magazine?
Well, it got a weird kind of recognition, which is that this sort of, this influential music reviewer for People magazine just took it upon himself. He was so into our demo that he reviewed it like it was a record in People magazine, which brought us a crazy amount of notoriety. Included, and he also mentioned our Dial-A-Song service.
Right.
And suddenly having this national exposure legitimized us to editors and other reviewers in a way that I don't think we ever would have been able to have achieved on our own.
Right.
And we were really, like, we had a P.O. box and, like, knew a tape duplicating service. And it was just very street level. I mean, to call it, you know, DIY is an understatement.
Right.
So that was kind of the first of many unusual lucky breaks. And then we ran into this video director at a show, this guy who had directed just a few things for Nickelodeon, named Adam Bernstein, and he basically just volunteered himself to direct our videos, and he was very ambitious himself and seemed to have a very clear idea of what he wanted to do. And we shot a bunch of these videos. They were very low-budget videos, but that kind of undermines the qualities that they had that were cool, which is they're shot on film at a time when a lot of rock videos were shot on video. And so they didn't. They actually looked strangely elegant, in spite of their obvious, you know, ultimate cheapness.
Right.
They actually looked pretty. In some ways, they looked much prettier. I mean, I remember when "Don't Let Start" kind of went into rotation on MTV. It was up against "How Do I Know" by Whitney Houston, which was like her first big single, and this was like that. She was like on the top of the charts, and they were. But they were also playing "Don't Let Start" quite a bit, and when you saw the videos kind of against one another, the strange thing was the Whitney Houston video seemed very kind of flat and video-y and even a little sweaty.
Right.
It was just really strange because, I mean, like I'm sure it cost literally 100 times more than our video.
Right. So, like, what was your guys' budget for that?
The first video we did, I had no budget at all. We did what's called
Put Your Hand Inside the Puppet Head.
Yeah, Puppet Head was the first one that had no budget. It was sort of exponential. I think Don't Let Start we made for a few $100s. I mean, I don't know what the official budget was. There was a lot. The biggest expenses were just like the art supplies and the transportation, and it was, I believe, I'm not sure. Don't Let Start or Anna Ang was actually shot on film that was tails. When you're making a feature film and the film remaining in the camera is too short to run a whole scene on.
Okay.
They create these things called tails, which is basically 45 seconds or a minute of film, and it's kind of the runoff. And so if you're making a feature film, you'll compile like these reels of short pieces of film, and they're kind of unreliable because you can't really shoot with it. So we shot, it was Married to the Mob, the Jonathan Demme film, was shot on the tails of that film. Were used to shoot the video for Don't Let's Start, I believe.
Wow, that seems pretty, like, that's like surreal.
Well, I mean, it was free. It was like we were just using the scrap, and we were doing some, like, what is it called? Upcycling. You know,
right.
We were just taking, because we were shooting a video, so how long is a shot in a video? 45 seconds, maybe? So it's like in the middle of it, mm-hmm. there's like a splice. It probably won't be the end of the world.
Right.
Because everything was kind of fast cut.
Right.
You know?
And it ended up looking so, I mean, the videos still look good to me. I mean, that's a great story, though.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, it was really quite a time. I mean, if anybody's wondering about, you know, whether or not they'll feel comfortable being broke, I can hardly recommend it. I'm broke all my life.
Actually, speaking of videos, here's a question for you. What's with the lack of videos between, like, John Henry and the Elts? Like, were you just, like, focusing on the music during that time, or?
Well, you know, it was very hard to come down, and before the YouTube video thing kind of broke the spell of budgets.
Oh,
okay. We were sort of trapped in a world where there wasn't really much demand for our songs on MTV. I mean, MTV had sort of stopped playing videos, and they certainly stopped playing our videos.
Right.
And the price of video production was still prohibitively high. You know, basically when everything kind of got reset by the YouTube thing, we kind of re-entered that world. But, I know what you mean. It was kind of, it's sort of frustrating, but
right.
No,
that makes sense.
I wish we had more to show visually from that era, but it was not to be.
Okay, well that's too bad. But I'm glad you seem like you've really like you're making up for lost time. Like there's so many videos.
We are. We've actually got some very cool. I don't know if you know who this guy Liam Lynch is. He actually He did a television show on MTV called, it was those crazy sock puppets, Syphil and Ollie.
Oh, really?
And he's directing a video for the title track of Nanobots. And it's insane.
That's awesome. I mean,
yeah.
I know him. He put out an album that I just find really, like, great. I don't know about the sock puppet thing.
He is an enigmatic dude. He's done a lot of different things, and he's very talented in a lot of different ways. I mean, I've only met him a couple times, but I like his style. I like the cut of his jib.
I love
that. But,
hey,
you know, I've got a dash. I've got another interview in, like, 2 minutes.
Oh, man.
It's been fast.
I had this list of questions I didn't even ask you, but you know.
Well, let's do it again in a week. Call him back and tell him I'll come back next week.
Okay, come back next week.
That'll be a gas.
It'll be a stone cold gas.
Cool.
It was just nice to chat with you. So
high
five. It's all good. High five.
Talk to you later.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.